Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Marilyn Berger, and she's doing an inquiring mind lecture called A Jury of Her Peers. Let's listen in on Marilyn.
I'd like to welcome you to the latest installment of our Inquiring Minds series. Professor Marilyn Berger is here this evening to talk to us about women and the law. And I'd like to give you a little biographical information about Professor Berger. She is a professor of law and the director of the Trial Advocacy Program at the Seattle University School of Law. After obtaining her law degree from the University of California at Berkeley, she worked for legal aid societies in New York and in California, and as an attorney in private law firms. Her academic career has included appointments to Kyoto University, the University of London, South Bank Polytechnic in London, and the University of Puget Sound, which is my alma mater. She has lectured internationally, focusing on issues of gender, culture, and law. And her topic tonight is A Jury of Her Peers. Thank you. Please. And before we, let's welcome her, and then I've got one more thing to say. I do need to mention that this program is a part of the Inquiring Minds series. And the Inquiring Minds series is made possible by the Washington Commission for the Humanities and is ultimately made possible through the National Endowment for the Humanities, which, if you have been reading the news, you know that is in some financial difficulty and governmental difficulty. And so we do ask for your support so that this program can continue. I have a few brochures up here if you'd like after the lecture to find out how you can help support the program. And I also have evaluations. The Washington Commission for the Humanities asked us to hand out evaluations. They would appreciate it if you would evaluate the talk so that they can continue to improve this lecture series. And if you have an organization back home, this is an excellent series. It costs you nothing. I mean, it's all paid for by the Washington Commission for the Humanities. And so it's an excellent resource for any organization in any community in Washington State. So, and you might want to say a bit more about that. But I'll just pass these around, and here's some pencils. If you just pass those pencils to Art, please.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted to be here. And I have a little script to start this tape. So even though you know who I am, I have to read this anyway. Roll the tape. My name is Marilyn Berger. The title of this session is Jury of Her Peers. Okay. And I am absolutely delighted to be here. I've never visited Holden Village before, and it is very peaceful and delightful. And I hope that my topic isn't too disturbing, bringing the real world back into where we are now. And what I did is I prepared a bibliography of the author that I'll be speaking about. So if you want to have more information about Susan Glass Bell, please feel free to take one of these. Okay, tonight I'm going to be taking us on a metaphorical journey, and I'm going to be looking at the American jury system through a short story called A Jury of Her Peers that was written by Susan Glass Bell back in 1916. And I'm going to focus on four stories. And once upon a time, they lived happily ever after. Unfortunately, the stories I'm going to be talking about are not so happy. I think all of you might be familiar with this story that was in the news before O.J. Simpson came along. And Mrs. Bobbitt did not have a jury of three blind mice, but in fact she had seven females and five males on the jury, who acquitted her for marital sexual assault. And what we're going to be looking at is to see, did it matter that there were seven women versus five men on the jury? Would there have been a different decision? In other words, do men and women hear and speak with the same voices? Do they make decisions the same way? And do they judge the same way? And I'll be exploring that in relationship to the jury system, of whether it matters whether a jury is all 12 women or all 12 men, or a mixture where that mixture is an imbalance, where there is are more men than women or more women than men. And the importance of that we can see in a number of cases I'll be discussing tonight, real cases. And we'll take a look on this in this metaphorical way of comparing our short story in 1916 that raises some of these issues in a very literary way to see whether or not it really does make a difference of whether you're judged by your peers or not. In order to do that, we're going to explore the American jury system, and to understand what a jury of peers is, we really have to look at the historical underpinnings of the American jury system. Where did we get our jury system? And then how did it become the system that we now all see on television on a daily basis? In other words, how do we get into the state that we are in today? And I've said that we're going to be taking a metaphorical journey because we're really going to be comparing one thing to another. We're going to be comparing the short story to reality. And what I'm going to be speaking about has more universal interest than just looking at the jury system. It impacts on our very lives and how we deal with one another if, in fact, men and women are communicating very differently and have different views. I'd like to start out with a summary of the 1916 story, A Jury of Her Peers. Minnie and John Wright lived in a desolate farmhouse, a lonesome-looking place among lonesome-looking trees. One wintry day, a farmer, Mr. Hale, came by looking for John Wright, and he found him. He found him strangled to death, a rope around his neck, lying in his bed. "Who did this, Mrs. Wright?" said Harry, the county attorney. He said it in a businesslike manner. "I don't know," she says. "You don't know," says Harry. "You were sleeping in the bed with him, and you don't know who killed him?" "I was on the inside," said Mrs. Wright. "Somebody slipped a rope around his neck, strangled him, and you didn't wake up?" says the county attorney. "I didn't wake up," she said. "I sleep sound," said Mrs. Wright. Mrs. Wright is in custody for the murder of her husband, John. Sheriff Peters, Mr. Hale, the farmer, and the county attorney are meeting at the farmhouse during this short story. The Sheriff Peters says, "Something to make a story about, a thing that would connect up with this clumsy way of doing it," the county attorney told the men. The sheriff's wife, Mrs. Peters, and Mrs. Hale, the farmer's wife, accompany the men to the farmhouse. It's 1916. The year of the short story. What was the role of women at that time? Most of us were not around then, but could you imagine what it was like in 1916?
Stay home, take care of the children,
vote. Right. Women did not even have the right to vote. That's right. And very few women even owned property in their own name at that point, although they had the right to. They weren't members of professions, and it wasn't considered professional to stay home and take care of the children or be a farmer's wife. If Mrs. Wright was tried at that time, the jury would have looked like this. 12 men would have decided the fate of Mrs. Wright. Now, when we look at our short story, though, we're going to be looking at it through the eyes of the two women who were at the farmhouse to see whether they would have judged Mrs. Wright very differently than the 12 men might have judged them. In other words, the two women will be Minnie Wright's jury of her peers. And I told you I'm going to talk about some not-so-happy stories, and these are real cases. State v. Hess, that was decided in 1991. Clara Hess, in the early morning hours in Park County, Montana, took a .22 caliber pistol, slipped it into her house dress, crept into the bedroom where her husband Bill was asleep, and shot him behind his right ear. Mrs. Hess was tried for first-degree murder for killing her husband. She claimed that she was a battered woman and used that as a defense. That, in other words, that she was in fear for her own life, and even though he was asleep, she still had that fear. A 12-person jury found Mrs. Hess guilty of first-degree murder, and she's imprisoned for life. Our last case is a 1994 case decided by the United States Supreme Court, J.E.B. versus T.B. Now, these folks are not happy dancers anymore. J.E.B. versus T.B. stands for the initials of the Mr. Bowman and Miss Bible. Mr. Bowman and Miss Bible had an affair, and from that affair, they had a child. And Mr. Bowman is now claiming that it is not his child. The state of Alabama has filed a paternity suit and asked for child custody from Mr. Bowman. Mr. Bowman, of course, is represented by a private attorney, and he contests that action. At the original trial, there were 12 women who determined the fate of Mr. Bowman. Now, how that happened is the state of Alabama, representing Ms. Bible, challenged all the males who came forth to sit on that jury because of their sexual position, just because they were males. And because of the configuration of the number of people that came to the courtroom, they wound up with a jury of 12 women. Mr. Bowman was very upset, of course, because they found against him. And he claimed that he was being discriminated against because he did not have a jury of his peers. And he took it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed that Mr. Bowman was entitled not to a jury of his peers, but to an impartial cross-section of the community, and you could not challenge people based on gender. Okay, with that in mind then, let's take a look at this. In the JEB case, Ms. Bible, the state of Alabama, won. Was it because all of the jurors were 12 women? In the State v. Bobbitt case, we have a mixture, but we have a predominance of women on that jury. Does it matter that there were only 4 men on that jury? In the State v. Clara Hess case, we have an equal number, even though they're not spaced exactly right. There are 6 men and 6 women. And is that going to give us a fair decision? Okay, let's take a look now at the jury system and where we get this whole idea of a jury of peers, because we keep on hearing that. This is our Sixth Amendment, which is the constitutional right to a jury in a criminal case. And nowhere in the Sixth Amendment does it say that you have a right to a jury of your peers. Rather, it says you have a right to an impartial jury when the state brings charges, and that jury will have to be from the area in which you live, in other words, the local community. In a civil case, the Seventh Amendment doesn't have anything that it mentions about what the composition is of a jury. It merely says that if you are involved in a controversy that involves more than $20, that you have a right to a jury. It has no words that actually say impartial, cross-section, or a jury of one's peers. So where does this idea come from that people keep screaming about and that we even heard in, if you remember, the O.J. Simpson original set of jurors, that he said that he was entitled to a jury of his peers. And the Rodney King case, where originally that case was tried by all white people with the police officers. Where is this idea that we somehow think that we have a right to a jury of peers, or should we have a right to a jury of our peers? Well, historically, we know that the jury system first started with the Greeks. But we're going to leave the Greeks aside because our system is really not modeled on the Greek system, but we can trace it directly from England. And the meaning of impartial never appeared in the jury system. Rather, it was always a jury of peers. And actually, it never even began with a jury system. The way that they began trials was not with a jury system, but with a choice that you either could go through what they called an ordeal, or you could have oaths. Let me describe the whole idea of trial by ordeal. The trial by ordeal was an accused defendant would be given a red-hot iron that they would have to grasp, he or she would have to grasp in their hands and walk 9 feet. The other ordeal was that you can dip your hand in a bucket of boiling water and pick out a stone that's attached to a string. And after you do either one of those ordeals, you then would have your hand bandaged. And after the bandages were taken off, if your hand was infected, then that meant that the curse of God was upon you and you were guilty. And if your hand healed, then you were innocent because God was shining on you saying that you were innocent. Well, that gave way because we thought that somehow even the church thought that that was a little bit much. And that gave way to the whole idea of people coming into court and swearing the credibility of the defendant. In other words, that they would come in and say, this defendant I've known for so many years and they're nice people, this person has never lied or done anything unkind. And there would be about 36 people from the community that would have to be summoned. If one person in that group of witnesses said any bad things about the defendant, then the defendant was found guilty. Again, that was thought, well, maybe that's not too fair. That gave way then to the jury system that began to resemble a little bit what we know today. But originally, that jury was people who knew about the incident. In other words, people from the community would be questioned, and people who had the most knowledge about the incident would then be asked to sit as jurors. Well, you could see that we don't use that system whatsoever. That gave way then to the idea that maybe that wasn't too fair because these people had predispositions to whether somebody was guilty or innocent. That gave way then to this idea of impartial. But when they came up with the impartial, they really, really were not talking about impartial. They were really talking about partial people. Because the first time that we actually see in written form the idea of what England thought was a jury was in the Magna Carta in 1215. And that's the first written account that we have of the jury system. And they say that you can't be found guilty except by a judgment, a legal judgment of his peers. Of course, women did not have any status in England at the time. Or by the laws of the land. So you could be tried by a judge or by a jury of peers. Now, the word peers really meant peers in England. What that meant, and this came from the barons of Runnymede at that battle, is that the barons wanted to be judged by landed aristocracy that were of equal rank than they were. So you'd have all these landed knights who would then be called as jurors because the king's men would then represent the king. And so the barons then got in the Magna Carta the words his peers, which truly meant peers, noble people that were landed aristocracy. Well, this was not really understood by the colonists at the time. And so in summary, what we have before we import it to the United States is that in England, peers were not of the same class. It had nothing to do with democracy. Originally, we had a jury by ordeal or interested people. The first jurors were people that knew about the situation and could come forth with knowledge. And it had nothing whatsoever to do with a foundation of democracy. In other words, their jury trials were not part of their democratic system, but rather a battle between the king's men and the noblemen in the land. Yet it was this jury that we imported because we never understood what the word peers really meant. The colonists imported this whole idea of peers, and we can see this actually when we start looking at the constitutions of the various colonies at the time. And here we are, and almost every colony, Massachusetts, Virginia, and a few other colonies actually adopted some of the language from the Magna Carta. All trial shall be by 12 men, and as near as may be, peers or equals, and of the neighborhood. Yet the colonists were using the word peers in a very different way. They were using it to mean their peers, because they were fighting the Tories, and every time a crime was announced against a colonist, the king's men would come forth and, of course, find them guilty, predisposed to find them guilty. And so the colonists then fought very hard to get the word peers in their constitutions for or their orders that carried out their governmental format at the time. Because they wanted colonists, and the word peers meant peers, people of general rank to them, and not the peers that were known in England. Well, what does this all mean? It means a whole lot when we begin to see the function of the jury and why we think that we have this system. In any case, this became a very, very important issue, and it was even, you can find allusions to it in the Declaration of Independence. And it became something that became very, very important and was one of the fights that we had with England, because they were trying to get rid of this system of jury trial by having the colonists sit. And so every time that there was a crime charge, they tried to have a non-jury trial, which would mean that the king's governor would then judge the guilt or innocence of the person. And that's how England looked at our jury system. So it became very, very different, and it became what we call a bulwark of democracy. It became one of the institutions that the colonists thought was very, very important and caused the breakaway from England. Okay, well, let's take a look now at actually the functions. Okay, as we've seen now, we have the Sixth Amendment, which we got in our Constitution as part of the Bill of Rights. And what we're seeing now is the word peers is not there anymore. We see it originally in the colonists' constitutions, but it's no longer in the Sixth Amendment. And that's because there was a fight between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And this was a compromise language of what impartial meant. And they thought, and nobody really interpreted what they meant by impartial. And there it sits. So there's no mention, as we can see, in the Sixth Amendment to peers any longer, because there was a compromise in the Bill of Rights. And the word impartial was never defined. Okay, well, how does that impact on our juries today? Anybody serve on a jury? Okay, how were you selected? Do you remember?
It was a long, long time ago, but I was sent a postcard.
Right.
To be there.
Okay, so from the general population, you got a postcard, right? And then what happened to you?
The judge called, I think it was the judge, who called different people and asked just a couple of simple questions.
Okay, well, somehow you came to court, right?
Yes.
Okay, did they find out whether you were actually qualified to sit as a juror?
No. I don't think so.
You didn't fill out any papers?
No.
Anybody have a different experience?
I filled out a paper and sent it in.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was called later to come in, and then I was selected for the jury.
Okay. What they usually do is that they send you a piece of paper, that postcard or to come in, and you fill out a form that means that you weren't a convicted felon without restored rights, that you were over the age of 18, and you could understand a trial that was conducted in English. That's basically what we require of jurors. And so all of you came into the court, okay, and then you eventually, where did you go when you came in? Do you remember?
To the main jury room.
Okay, and how many people were in there?
Probably 100 people.
Okay. 100 to 200 people. Okay, and then what happened to you?
And then the judge selected certain people to go to another courtroom.
Right.
And then more than 12 people, because the lawyers had to select 12 people to put on the jury.
Right. Okay, and that's this group down here. Okay, so that's what basically happens. You go from the general population all the way down to about 50 people or so, or maybe sometimes less, 30 people, that go to the courtroom. Out of these 50 people, you have to get a jury, usually of 12 people. It can be less, depending on the jurisdiction. Okay, now, the people, the 50 coming in, though, something happens to you, right? You don't get to sit just because you're sitting in the courtroom. You've got to get rid of some of those people. Okay. And that's how the JV case came about with 12 women. Okay, what we had were challenges. Okay, did you get to sit on the jury that you marched into the courtroom? Do you remember?
The second time around.
Okay, what happened the first time around?
They had enough people before they came.
Okay. And that happens, and then you marched off. Mm-hmm. The second time, what happened?
rape trial, and there were quite a few people were challenged.
Okay. Okay, you were selected. So let's talk about those challenges, okay? You didn't go through any challenges. Anybody go through challenges? Did you get to sit on the jury when you... What happened to you?
I was questioned by both the defense and the prosecutor.
Uh-huh.
And it was a bunch of, I'm pretty sure it's attorneys.
Uh-huh.
And other attorney.
And they decided they didn't want you. They give you any reason?
Well, the insurance attorneys didn't want me.
Did they tell you why? Okay, exactly.
I don't know why, but...
Okay, two ways that they could get rid of people. Two types of challenges. One challenge is called challenges for cause, okay? Where you actually have a reason why you are told that you can't sit on the jury. And it may be because you answer a question, you say, I absolutely, positively can't be fair. There's no way I can look at this evidence and find anything but guilt or innocence for this particular defendant or party. And then the judge says, well, thank you very much. We really, and you're sure. And you say, absolutely, positively. Now, those are the smart people that decide to do that. They've learned the system and know how to get out of that jury system. And if you, in fact, keep on saying that, you eventually, within a day or two, will no longer even find yourself sitting very long in the courtroom because you'll be bumped off constantly. Okay, those are called challenges for cause, and it's because you're related to somebody or because you absolutely can't be fair. Okay, and they're listed by statutes. The other way is peremptory challenges, and peremptory challenges can be thrown by both sides, the plaintiff or the defendant, or in a criminal case by the prosecutor or the defense. And they could be for no reason whatsoever. It could be because this woman is wearing a green dress, and I know people who wear green dresses always decide a certain way. I mean, I just know it. It's just a gut feeling, says the insurance defense counsel. And I know that men who wear purple suits will always vote for the plaintiff, so I'm going to get rid of all of those people. But they don't have to tell you. So it could be for absolutely no reason whatsoever, but their gut stereotypes that they have come into court with. It's the stereotypes that everybody walks around with, that Irish people will give grand, big, juicy verdicts, and Lutherans will give very small verdicts, okay? And we all know that those kinds of prejudice exist, and those stereotypes are allowed to happen in the jury system. It's a gut reaction. Now, in the JEB case, that's exactly what was going on, because the state of Alabama said, if I have all women, they're going to find paternity. I just know it when they hear the facts of this case. And JEB, Mr. Bowman, said, if I have women on that jury, you know, I'm going to be found to be the father. So the JEB wants to get rid of all the women, and the state wants all the women on. Well, by the configuration of that jury, the number of people, the 50 people who walked into the courtroom, 36 of them were women. So there was no way that Bowman was going to get his way. And they wound up because of the number of challenges with the 12 women. And that's how we got those challenges that then went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was the first time the Supreme Court recognized that gender could not be a reason that you have to bump somebody off. In other words, if you have a stereotype that all women will vote a certain way on a rape case or on a battered women's case, you can't use that as the reason to get rid of one gender versus another. Now, you can get around that, says the Supreme Court, because you can have another reason. And so if you have a nurse who's a woman, well, you know that nurses will vote a certain way. And if the woman is a homemaker, then I know home. So you can get around that rule, but you can't use just your gut reaction. And that's a JEB case. Actually works in reality. Okay, to summarize then, what we've learned then, before we go back to our story, is that the American jury system wants impartial jurors. We look for a cross-section, so you can't bump off all males or all females. And you also can't use race. You can't bump off one race because you have a stereotypical reason to do that. And we select juries by peremptory challenges. And I might add, it's an actual selection that I want the most prejudiced people for my side, is what the peremptory challenge system does. and we Pierce remains totally undefined.
Isn't there a limited number of preparations?
There are, and it depends on the case and the jurisdiction. Okay, it depends on how many defendants and plaintiffs and so on. It usually is three for each side unless there's some complication. Okay, and in capital murder cases, it's way more than that. Okay, let's take a look how this impacts on the functions of the American jury system. Okay, most of you kind of know what a jury does, but let me refresh some of these. A jury is a fact finder. So in other words, a jury looks at the evidence and judges in terms of their own perception. They review the evidence presented, and they decide the significance of that evidence. And we'll go through these in application to our short story. The second thing is the jury applies the law that the judge gives them to the evidence in front of them. And that's the application of the community standard. And the community standard is basically, we see that in, for example, pornography cases, where the jury is told, you decide whether this book is pornographic according to your community standard. And so that's when the jury decides what pornography actually is or is not. And that occurs in certain types of cases. The third function that the jury has is actually it's a foundation of democracy. It's the only time that citizens can participate in a branch of government. One of the three branches of government. And you come in and you can temper the law, you can bring your community standard, and what the jury does together when they go in and deliberate is part of that foundation of democracy, the sharing of ideas and deciding what justice truly should be. Now, one of the things happened with these things is this little group came along, the attorneys. And what they did is they decided that this function of the community standard of justice, which is applying the law to the evidence, should no longer be put in the hands of the jury. So in many cases now, the judge will, most cases, the judge instructs the jury that in fact, it is not your perception of the law that you should be deciding on, but the law that I give you. And the judge does that in jury instructions. Now, we know of cases where that, in fact, doesn't happen. And we distrust this attorney six-pack. Most of you might remember the Bernard Goetz case. Do any of you remember that? The subway vigilante? Just to refresh some people who may not remember all the facts on that, Bernard Goetz was riding in the New York City subway, and he was really sick and tired of being mugged and accosted for money. And he saw some youths who he thought were going to come along and mug him, and he pulled his gun and he shot them before they actually got to mug him. And he shot one of the youths in the back, and the teenager died. And Bernard Goetz was charged, or the district attorney wanted to charge him with first-degree murder. And what happened was, in New York, they have a system of sending it to the grand jury to come up whether or not the person should be charged. It's a different system than Washington uses. And the grand jury decided that they would not indict Bernard Goetz. In other words, these 18 grand jurors decided not to follow the prosecutor's orders. They just ignored the law. And so the prosecutor waited until the grand jury was disbanded, got a new grand jury that the court handpicked. And these grand jurors then indicted Bernard Goetz for a number of charges, amongst them first-degree murder. It went to a jury trial, and after the evidence, the case was submitted to the jury. And the high charge was premeditated first-degree murder and second-degree murder and manslaughter, and then the lesser charge of carrying a concealed weapon without a license, because Bernard Goetz did not have a license for his handgun. And the jury, after all the evidence and months of testimony, found that Bernard Goetz was only guilty of carrying a handgun without a license. So that was an indication of the jury taking the law and deciding what they thought the law should be, that in fact Bernard Goetz had the right to self-help as a vigilante, and did not look at the jury instructions at all in that case.
Also, sort of an indication of where the public was at that time. Since
exactly.
The jury was also
exactly.
Guilty of
exactly. And, but that's not what the lawyer said jury should do. Okay, because we've taken that function away from the jury, except in basically in pornography cases. Okay, so let's see now how all this impacts on the composition of the jury and whether or not it matters to have a jury that is all women, all men, mixed, and the mixture. Okay, I'm going to put up this overhead. And tell me what your reaction is to it. What about it?
It's not. The roles are opposite, probably.
Yeah, the roles are opposite, exactly. And why do you say the roles are opposite? It really should be. You're right. Dad's garage and mom's kitchen, right? Okay, now, this has implications in the jury system. It has implications in everything that we do. We have defined roles, and although those roles sometimes are changed, stereotypically we know that this is not the major way that most people operate. It's still very much like this. Now, it may change, and it's in the process of changing, but right now it's not. So taking that stereotype, social scientists have then looked at what are the implications of these roles. In other words, that men and women do different things most of the times. Well, what they've come up with is that, in fact, this impacts on what women may see and remember and what men may see and remember, and has implications for the jury system. So, for example, if I asked, I hope I picked correctly at this point. Sometimes I don't, and the whole thing blows up. Sir, if I asked you how many frying pans are in your kitchen, could you tell me?
Yes.
Oh, you see? It doesn't work sometimes. Okay. And what about, could you tell me?
Because they do the dishes, though.
Okay, so you do the dishes. Okay. But in terms of which frying pans are best to use for certain things, could you tell? Okay, at least that holds up. And if I asked you what was going on, how many wrenches are in the garage, would you know? Okay, so that it basically holds up. So if you went into the garage and you had a moment to look and see what was going on in the garage, you would probably not remember very accurately where the things were placed, because your experience level, you're not used to looking at wrenches and things in garages or in basements and tools and stuff. And sir, if I asked you which omelet, which frying pan would be best for an omelet, you probably would have to guess because you wouldn't know. So that what you take away from an eyewitness account is what you put into it. In other words, your role defines how comfortable you will be in remembering certain details from that incident. And that has implications for eyewitness identification and for how you perceive testimony and the significance of that testimony. So, with that in mind, let's return to our short story in 1916. The county attorney, who's now in the house, says, "I guess we'll go upstairs first, then out to the barn and around." But before leading the men outside, he goes into the kitchen on his way out, and he looks around. And he puts his hand up in a cupboard, and he pulls it out, and he says, "Yuck, what a sticky mess." And he's quite resentful. He then turns to wash his hands in the kitchen sink of the farmhouse, and he goes to wipe them on a set of towels that's right next to the sink. And he says, "Dirty towels, not much of a housekeeper, would you say, ladies?" And as a parting gesture, comment, the county attorney, leaving the two women in the kitchen alone among the kitchen things, says, "No telling, you women might come upon a clue to the motive, and that's the thing we need." And the men march out to the barn, and the women are left in the kitchen to sort through things, because they are there to get a few things for Minnie Wright, who is in jail and has requested a few things. The women see the cupboard, and they see the fruit. Mrs. Hale observes, "It's a shame about her fruit, all that hard work during the hot summer. Why, I remember last summer when I put up my cherries." and they notice the towels. There's a great deal of work to do on a farm. Men's hands get dirty awful quick. Men's hands aren't always as clean as they might be. They then go into the bedroom, and they notice that it's very stark and cold. And they're there to pick up some things for Minnie. And they notice, "Right was stingy," Mrs. Hale exclaimed, holding up a shabby black skirt that bore the marks of making over. "You don't enjoy things very much when you dress very shabby. But, oh, that was 20 years ago when she was a choir girl and she used to wear such pretty things." They then go back into the kitchen, and they notice the stove. "How'd you like to cook on this thing?" they said, pointing to the broken lining on the stove. And then they notice a quilt that's sitting on the rocking chair. And they notice that part of it is very finely stitched. Another part of it has very uneven stitching. This one, why, it looks as if she didn't know what she was about. And then they notice the bird cage in the corner. The sheriff's wife said, "Did she have a bird, Mrs. Hale?" "Maybe she did. I remember that man that was coming through last summer selling canaries. She used to sing real pretty herself." The sheriff's wife looks closer at the bird cage. "It's broke. One of the hinges is pulled apart." Mrs. Hale comes closer. "It looks as if somebody pulled the hinge off, was real rough with it." They then turn their attention and they see the sewing box that Minnie wanted. And they open it and they found inside a box. And inside was wrapped something in silk. "It's the bird," cried the sheriff's wife. Its neck is wrung." The men saw a messy cupboard and dirty towels, nothing but the insignificance of kitchen things. The women did not see just insignificant things. It was trivia to the county attorney, significant for the women. Minnie had a hard life of a farm wife. The impossibility of perfection was always there for her. Now, am I saying that dirty towels and messy fruit means that she's a homicidal maniac? No. But I'm saying that they have a very different perspective of what they saw when they were in the same place at the same time. The men did not see anything but the trivia of kitchen things, and the women saw the fruit and what it meant, the dirty towels, the cold room, the shabby clothes, the broken stove, the broken bird cage, the uneven sewing on the quilt, and a dead bird. Their eyes met. Something flashed to life between them. Something passed, and they seemed to have difficulty pulling away from each other. Let's take a look at the second thing that we do during a jury trial. Applying the law, remember the law, to the evidence, the thing that the lawyers didn't trust. And in this area, we're really looking at the definition of what is criminal conduct and who is the accused and who is the victim. The feminists have said in looking at the law that there is no such thing as ungendered law, that there is a gendered perspective to all law. And I think we can see this when you take a look at the history of some very modern wrongs that we've seen now being redressed in court, such as sexual harassment. It used to be perfectly legitimate for men to have pinups in the workplace, even if it bothered women. It was perfectly legitimate to pinch bottoms or give a pat where a pat shouldn't be, and there was no redress to that. It was perfectly legitimate to call it a family matter when women were battered and beaten. When the police arrived, it's a mere family matter and arrests were not warranted. It was perfectly legitimate to not enforce child support payments because most men were responsible for those payments. So what are the implications of looking at the law as gendered? Let's take a look again at our 1916 short story. Who is the victim in this case, and who is the accused? Is it Minnie, the victim, or is she really the accused? The men see John Wright as the victim. He was a good man. Yes, good. He didn't drink. He kept his word. He paid his bills. The women have a very different point of view. They look at John Wright as a cold-hearted man. The stinginess with the old stove, her shabby clothes, her lonesomeness, killing her bird. Mrs. Hale said, He was a hard man, she told the sheriff's wife, just to pass the time of day with him. He's like a raw wind gets to the bone. The men find that Minnie Wright is guilty, the defendant. Looks bad for her. Funny way to kill a man with a gun in the house yet. The women see Minnie as the victim. She was kind of like a bird herself, real sweet and pretty, the kind of timid and fluttery. How she did change. Minnie is not a criminal to them, but merely the helpless executioner who has already been suffering and punished for all the years that she spent in that cold, locked away farmhouse. Mrs. Hale doesn't disagree that John Wright was strangled. It was an awful thing to put a rope around one's neck. But we are focusing with the women on Minnie as the real victim. The women see the wrong as a failure to give warmth and companionship. The men see it merely as a crime, and they don't see any crime that was committed against Minnie Wright. And we know the FBI does not arrest one for the lack of warmth and companionship, at least not yet. The women are describing a very different kind of conduct that the criminal law does not punish. If there had been years and years of nothing and then a bird to sing to you, it would be awful still when that bird was killed. And then Mrs. Hale goes further. She says, oh, I wish I'd come over here once in a while. I wish, that was a crime. Who's going to punish that? Not the law. It's 75 years later, and we have the case of Clara Hess. Clara testified that Bill subjected her to physical, sexual, and verbal abuse, that he threatened her with a gun. Some witnesses for Clara claim that he was abusive, controlling, and hot-tempered. Other witnesses for Bill said that he was kind-hearted and gentle. The defense called an expert witness who testified that Clara Hess was a battered woman and that, in fact, she was in imminent danger of harm, that she feared for her life, that, in fact, she couldn't get over the fact that if Bill Hess woke up, that he would kill her tomorrow. The jury was asked to put themselves in the position of Clara Hess, to understand that imminent harm for Clara Hess meant that it didn't mean that he had to be awake, that even sleeping, he was just as much a harm to her, that she feared for her life. What was the criminal conduct that the jury was asked to judge? Was it the battering by Bill or the killing of the batterer by Clara? The concept of self-defense includes an imminence requirement. In other words, you have to be in imminent danger of one's life. It has to be a momentary second that you fear that somebody will hurt you. Well, does that really apply to women? The jury was asked to dispel what years and years the law had taught them, that women really like those beatings, that they are, that they invoke them, that they intentionally provoke their batterers. And this jury did not accept the fact that Clara Hess was a battered woman. In order to see what happens of why you have a different result depending on the mixture of the jury, we really have to look at that third function. And the third function is this democracy function. The jury does its work in deliberations. In other words, nothing is written, everything is verbal. And when the jury gets their instructions along with the evidence, they go into the jury room and they deliberate, which we then think is very, very important to have a cross-section, because the more people you have, the more views will be exchanged. And this is the democracy part of the jury function, a free exchange of ideas to articulate this community standard. Now, one of the things that happens when the jury goes in is they go in exactly as they were in life. They wear the same clothes. In other words, men don't put on skirts and dresses, and women don't put on pants. And they also go in with the same mental apparatus that they had in real life. They go in with their status, with their roles, and with what they perceive is important and not important. And this has implications in mixed groups. Social scientists had not studied juries since 1952, but what they have done is done some mock studies, and social scientists have looked at what happens in mixed groups. And what they found in mixed groups is that in 66% of the time, when there's a mixture of more men than women, or an equal number of men and women, that in fact the men dominate the conversation, and that women talk only 34% of the time. That as the men talk, the women's silences get greater and greater. And the men may interrupt or overlap in conversation, and the women have more and more of a minimal response. And in fact, in some juries, in mock jury studies, the female speaker is totally ignored. And there's another observation that's been made in real juries, is that in only 20% of the cases, there are female four people. In other words, the four person of the jury is a woman only 20% of the time. This is pretty important because the four person is the person that runs the deliberations, usually, and is the most influential speaker. And what it turns out is the people who speak more turn out to be the most persuasive speakers. And if you have the four people, usually as males, that it's found that they, in fact, will dominate the decision-making process. Could that have been the case in Clara Hess's jury? Well, we have what's called a critical mass. We have six women and six men, remember? And on top of it, we have a female foreperson. So what are stereotypical roles of thinking? What happens in social scientist roles does not happen in the Clara Hess case. And this is an anomaly from all the jury studies that have been done up to date. Let's go back for a minute and take a look at what this jury might have done that could have been different. And we see this in the 1916 short story. There are two ways that juries deliberate. The first way is a verdict-driven deliberation. In other words, everybody gets in the jury room and they take a straw poll to decide. Is that what happened when you were in the jury? Take a straw poll to see where people are, whether they think that the person is guilty or innocent. And depending on that straw poll, it then makes it determines, it solidifies positions. And then what happens, people harden in those positions and they try to gather evidence to support their position as opposed to listening to other people's viewpoint. The other way the juries deliberate is an evidence-driven deliberation, which is that the jury looks at all the evidence that is presented and makes a determination. In other words, weighs the evidence and sees that, yes, this is the case, or no, this is not the case. Okay, and we can see these two different styles when we look at the 1916 short story. Something to make a story about, says the county attorney, a thing that would connect up with this clumsy way of doing it, the county attorney told the men. So the men have come into the farmhouse determined to find Minnie Wright guilty, and it's just that they're looking for the evidence to fit into the picture. The women, on the other hand, do the following. Mrs. Hale held up a box. What a pretty box. There's something wrapped up in it. A piece of silk, faltered Mrs. Hale. Oh, it's the bird, cried the sheriff's wife. It's the bird. Its neck is broken. Look at its neck. In a voice that was slow and deep, she said, somebody wrung its neck. She liked the bird, said Mrs. Hale. She was going to bury it in that pretty box. No, Wright wouldn't like that bird, a thing that sang. She used to sing, and he killed that, too. Mrs. Hale's voice was tight. Footsteps were heard on the stairs. It's all perfectly clear, except the reason for doing it, the county attorney said incisively. If there's some definite thing, something to show, something to make a story about, a thing that would connect up with this clumsy way of doing it, and the sheriff and the county attorney walked through the kitchen to the other room and went out to look at the horses one more time. For one final moment, the two women were alone in that kitchen. Slowly, unwillingly, the two women's eyes met, unflinching in a steady, burning stare. no evasion nor flinching. Mrs. Peters reached out and took the box. She tried to stuff it into the pocket of her coat. It was too big. Mrs. Hale stood there for one moment, then grabbed it and put it into her purse. The sound of a knob turning. Mrs. Hale had put the box in her coat. When Mrs. Hale and Mrs. Peters hid the strangled bird, the thing that to the women explained why Minnie, in like manner, had put a rope around her husband's neck while he slept. To them, they thought that justice was done. They knew that the jury of 12 men would never understand the hardness of living in that farmhouse, that she had already suffered too much, that Wright had got his due. Mrs. Hale and Mrs. Peters were a jury of Minnie's peers. As the old English system, where the people had to be familiar with the crime and the people, they were knowledgeable persons who were of like social and economic status with Minnie's peers. They were saying, yes, I do speak for all women. And what we're left with then is, was this a jury of Miss Bible's peers? Should she have had that right? And what went wrong with the Hess jury when there were 6 men and 6 women? Does it matter if there are 12 women? Do you have to have more than 6? Or do juries do very different things than what social scientists think happens in mixed groups? Thank you. Do you have questions?
Comments? Well, I think it has more to do with the experience of the human being rather than the gender.
Mm-hmm.
Because juries don't go into the household of O.J. Simpson and sift through the evidence, such as the short story. However, it is possible that males could have an experience that would give them a perspective to that would be similar to Mrs. I don't know the short story mm-hmm. woman's mm-hmm. name. So I think it really has more to do with your experience
mm-hmm.
in terms of peers than it does have to do with your gender. And it just so happens that in our culture, generally speaking, the experience of males and females are have these roles too. But I don't think that I could say that I think that it's always going to be the female is going to have that perspective that you just
right.
talked about, mm-hmm. and the male is going to have the opposite perspective.
That's right, and I think that's what we saw in the Clara Hess case, that in fact, justice was more important than the perspective than the people brought in. But there was another thing going on there, which was that it's not commonly accepted that if you're given an instruction of imminence, what she was saying is, I shot my husband while he slept because I was in fear of my life. And our perspective is, how could you fear somebody when, in fact, he's asleep? And so the very instruction is a gendered instruction because it doesn't take into account that women don't look at self-defense the same way men do. But given that instruction, the jury could have done nothing but convict in that case.